So I'm Violet Blue, and for those of you who aren't familiar with my work, I am primarily a sex educator. I've been a sex educator for about 10 years, which means that I'm a trained sex educator. I lecture to UCs and community teaching institutions about human sexuality. I'm the author of, well, honestly, over 2 dozen books, but on Amazon, about 19 or 20 books. I have a bunch of e-books and interesting things coming out pretty soon as well about sex and sexuality. I'm also an erotica editor. For some weird reason, I'm now the sex writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, which is pissing off the conservatives to no end, and so I am having a blast with it. So I'll enjoy that while it lasts, for certain, which is why the comments are always so nice. And also, I have had a very strong online presence, as probably quite a few of you know, a pretty popular podcast that's been all over the place, from like Newsweek to the Wall Street Journal and all that stuff, because it's about porn. And part of where this talk comes from, this is a talk about sexual privacy online, and part of where this talk comes from is that I started working for a site called Fleshbot.com around early 2005. And I had been friends with Jono, who was the man who launched the site for Gawker Media back in 2003, since its inception, and we had sort of been in contact. Well, he just reblogged a whole bunch of my stuff until finally in 2005 he was like, I would love you to be the second person writing on the site. So we ran the site together, which basically made me a canary in a porn mine. On the internet, because at that time we were 12 or 15 posts a day, and so we would be just scouring the internet for porn and for all kinds of everything, from news to like personal blogs to basically anything we could find out there. And so we became, you know, and we also wanted to be ethical about what we presented to the people who came to our site in terms of like not sending them to circle jerk links, not sending them to places that would install spyware and crap on their computers. So we had to be pretty savvy about, you know, like the dirty tactics that people were using to do whatever they were doing on the internet that had to do with sex. And also be aware of the sexual politics involved in sex and sexuality, because we reported a lot of sex news. But to make a long story short, the reason that I wanted to make my talk about sexual privacy online is that now, especially now that I'm more in the limelight and I'm talking more to mainstream media about sex and sexuality, I'm realizing that a lot of it comes back to sexual privacy. And so what I wanted to do today was talk about just a variety of aspects of sexual privacy online and talk about some things that you guys might not know about and some first-person experiences that I've had and that I've witnessed that I've found pretty surprising. So, and I'm going to be reading quite a bit from this because this is a pretty research talk and I want to make sure I get all my facts correct. So one of the things that I've noticed about while working on Fleshbot and also just in the wider, you know, being a sex blogger arena is just how much the internet has changed human sexuality and how much people aren't really realizing it at this point. And that it's such a radical force, and because it's such a radical force in changing the way our culture is seeing sex and sexuality, that it's being perceived actively as a threat to a lot of different people. Why? Because for the first time, I think possibly in history, people have anonymity about sex, their sexual interests, their sexual explorations, and their sexual expressions. Or at least they feel as though they have true anonymity and privacy when it comes to sex. Sexual anonymity has been the key in the lock for everyone with a computer and a mouse, and of course it's become a double-edged sword for trolls, but lucky for us, trolls are stupid, so they're easily defeated most of the time. And why this is so alarming to a lot of people who are anti-sex is because the dissemination of sexual information has been controlled for a very long time. It's been a body of information that's been commodified, locked down, and made virtually inaccessible by interests ranging from politics and distribution networks to exclusivity agreements. Through the internet's perceived anonymity, the privacy it's afforded to surfers, artists, writers, and consumers has made sexuality accessible to everyone. It's my belief that each person's sexuality is as individual to them as a fingerprint, and the internet is the resource people now look to for assembling their own sexual operating systems. It's like a free market capitalist approach to sex. Sure, there's abstinence education in schools, but anyone with a computer will be able to learn how to make their own choices because of the democratic dissemination of sex information that's happening online from sex ed to porn, anonymously, in the privacy of their own home. The problem, of course, is that people aren't as anonymous and private as they think. There is an illusion of sexual privacy online. If people knew just how much their privacy was at risk when they paid for porn or posted or answered that Craigslist ad or searched for canine in Google, would they still do it? Probably. It's easy for those of us who know our way around the internet to laugh at Nigerian bank scammer victims, but the internet is growing new users every single day and will continue to until you people stop breeding. But no one's telling people not to do stupid things like give out personal information in sexual situations from experimentation and masturbation to point of purchase, because the whole topic is still stupidly taboo. So the first example I want to talk about is the Craigslist experiment. Is anyone here familiar with the Craigslist experiment? Okay, I'd say about half the room. It's not a pretty picture, folks, I'm sorry. It gets progressively uglier, too. In September 2006, griefer extraordinaire Jason Fortuny and his friend took a hardcore women-seeking men ad from another city and reposted it on Craigslist Seattle to see how many responses they could get in 24 hours. Then he published every single response, photos, emails, IM info, phone numbers, names, everything, to the public wiki Encyclopedia Dramatica. Then they went public on Jason's LiveJournal page, calling it the Craigslist Experiment. This is still live, too. They invited readers to identify Craigslist ads responders and add more. Quote, your goal, identify people you know in real life and point them out. We've already had great successes here. It wasn't just any kind of ad, but a hardcore BDSM ad posting where a female submissive was looking for a rough male dominant to beat her up and fuck her. That's the text of the post. The ad's language suggests to me that the original poster actually had no idea what the language they were using meant. Clearly, what the person was asking for well beyond the included safe, same SM community definitions. This and a few other details suggested to me and a couple of other sex educators that the original ad may have been placed by a man experimenting with trans identity as well. That was a theory we had. But the point is, Jason and his cohort took the ad at face value as an average and got a face value response to what the ad's message sent to the world. They got 178 responses, with 145 photos of men, cocks, faces, and more, full email addresses, both personal and military addresses, names, and a few IM names that another used a USAR Army military email address, and one respondent used a Microsoft employee email address. They got audio, too. After, there was a copycat in Portland. Respondents emailed Fortuny asking him to take the info down, and he simply published their requests. Now, graphic. That was the image that was accompanying the ad. I thought you might want to see that because it's so pretty. It's so anonymous, it could be anyone. Fortuny then had his private information published to Craigslist and was threatened physically with lawsuits and has been hated on by everyone from online BDSM communities to Wired, who called him sociopathic. Commenters posted things like, quote, disclosing an email to the public is indeed a violation of privacy. And if anyone has a spine, they will take you down with a massive lawsuit that will make you regret ever doing this. You are a liar, a xenophobe, an asshole, and deserve to have your ass beaten to within an inch of your life. Anyone who lost a job over this deserves to sue you for all their future income. Sending a picture to someone over email is not the same as having a license to legally post it online. You will go down. You better start planning your escape from the country and change your name, cockbag. While researching my sex books, I've placed Craigslist ads just to get a random sampling or to get ideas. I always post as female. Every time, I've received an overwhelming amount of troll responses with unsolicited photos, which I get on my website anyway, too. Actually, now I get a lot more through the Chronicle, which I think is really interesting. Because they have a Chronicle address that they made for me, but without my consent, and they have it on the site. They didn't ask. So I get all kinds of really interesting emails with pictures. I have always wanted to do something with these responses or photos, of course, as they are often offensive and sometimes pretty evil. I never get past the thought process involved in doing any pranks, even though thinking about doing something makes me somehow feel better about it, as I would by outing the same kind of creepy guys that stalk me and harass my female friends online. I think about it and joke about it with friends. Sometimes I'll even chat with other chick sex educators, laughing over beers and comparing the unsolicited photos we've gotten recently just via our web presence, like, you got a face pic, you rate. Then again, I'm not pretending to be something I'm not. In the case of the Craigslist experiment, everyone was pretending to be something they were not and made a big, incorrect assumption about privacy. Ultimately, a high percentage of these guys' lives were changed in a major way. Some might argue that the Craigslist experiment was an inevitable form of online natural selection. If you have something to lose, don't do something that could make you lose it. And I also think that if our culture was made to feel less ashamed about sex, Jason's results would be quite different. Interestingly, after I posted about this on my website, I received a follow-up and an email from someone who sent an email to the Kings County Prosecuting Attorney's Office asking for comment. The response was that Jason doesn't seem to be breaking any laws yet. And according to Daniel T. Satterberg, Chief of Staff, King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, based on what I've read in the media accounts, I would say that there is no violation of our state criminal code involved here. Yay, griefers. Score one for the griefers. So, here we go. Last month, an Arizona police officer was officially fired for running a sex website with his wife when off the clock. A three-judge Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals panel here in San Francisco, I'll add, ruled against the former officer's First Amendment free speech right and right to privacy focus case, which of course directly affects any individual's sexual privacy online. The judges ruled that because what the former officer did was vulgar, indecent, sleazy, and disreputable, those words are all in quotes, he has no right to keep his job as a public servant. The thing is, what the former officer and his wife did was simple, boring amateur porn, I'm sorry. But it was basically just like him and her having sex, her jacking off, her occasionally swinging with another girl. They were just swingers with a basic garden variety, low grade, like just we're just a couple pay site, basically. So the only offense here is that one couple was being sexually expressed online. And according to Reuters, this is the Reuters report, an Arizona police department had the right to fire a police officer who made and sold vulgar and indecent sex videos in which he performs with his wife. U.S. Appeals Court ruled. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said on Wednesday that Robert Dibble had engaged in sleazy activities and ruled that a lower court had properly dismissed Dibble's claims that the Chandler, Arizona Police Department infringed his First Amendment rights to free speech by firing him. What's interesting about this is that this was just last month, and they weren't doing anything that would be considered obscene by so-called community standards. Not all of the judges on the panel agreed. One of the judges wrote a dissenting opinion, and I have a concise bit of it here, which I think is really interesting and adds to our discussion. I think I have another image. Yes, that's from Gay Pride. With all due respect, this is Judge Canby, Circuit George, concurring the judgment. With all due respect, I am unable to join the majority opinion because I disagree with its resolution of Dibble's First Amendment speech claim. Under the facts of this case and the existing precedent, the police department could not discharge Dibble for his website expression without violating the First Amendment. Dibble's website activity was not employment-related. However, as the majority opinion points out, Dibble was careful not to identify himself or his website with the police department or with police status at all. Now, I recognize that pornography, although apparently popular, is not a very respected subject of First Amendment protection in many quarters. The majority opinion here reflects the distaste, variously characterizing Dibble's expressive activities as vulgar, indecent, sleazy, and disreputable. But vigorous enforcement of the free speech guarantee of the First Amendment often requires that we protect speech that many, even as a majority, find offensive. Pornography and sexual expression in general is protected by the First Amendment when it does not constitute obscenity, and there is no showing that Dibble's expression meets that extreme standard. When applied to sexually expressive activities, this ruling has disturbing potential for expansive application. A measurable segment of the population, for example, is vigorously antagonistic to homosexual activity and expression. It could easily be encouraged to mobilize where a police officer discovered to have engaged in off-duty and unidentified by his activity in a gay pride parade or expressive cross-dressing or any number of other expressive activities that might fan the embers of antagonism smoldering in a part of the population. So, the next story is a bit more of a personal story. It's the story of anonymous sex blogger girl with a one-track mind. This is a screen grab from last night, from her site. So as I told you, I've been a blogger and occasional Girl Friday editor at fleshbot.com for the past few years. A job when full-time requires me to scour the internet for explicit sexual content of reasonable quality. We endeavor to cover a wide range of sexual expression and genders and orientations. One of our regular features is the sex blog roundup. When I did it weekly, I had upwards of 200 text-only sex blogs written by individuals worldwide in my RSS reader. Outside the 50 or so usual suspects of Variety, sex blogs, mainstream media news, link dumps, and sex news blogs. Every week, I'd have to call for new blogs to add to my feeds because invariably a handful of sex bloggers who were blogging anonymously had to quit blogging, meaning they were, for one reason or another, no longer anonymous. It was such a regular occurrence, I developed a snarky attitude toward the limited lifespan anonymous sex blogger, even though they often offered up the juiciest and most explicit posts about sex. There are still a lot of regular anonymous sex bloggers who maintain their privacy, but are extremely careful and web savvy in doing so, although I know a number of them outside their web personas, from New York to Alaska and to London, where I found the hot posts of single anonymous female sex blogger, the loved and respected girl with a one-track mind. And as an aside, when Audacia Ray was here promoting her book Naked on the Internet, which is a really great book about women's sexual expression online, I asked her what she found surprising in doing all of her research. And the thing that she said she found most surprising was how much women believed they could actually be and stay anonymous online. She found it really shocking that they thought they could really stay anonymous online. So, when I visited London a few years back, I met the girl in the flesh, and we had a night of good English drinking. We went to several pubs, got very wasted. It was a lot of fun. Even though we were hanging out as friends, she declined to tell me her real name the entire time that we were hanging out together. But she did tell me that she wanted to get a book deal based on her blog and asked my advice. She later did get that book deal, named after her blog, and upon publication in August 2006, found herself ambushed outside her London flat by paparazzi and outed in the UK tabloids 3 days after the book was published. Abby Lee is not her real name. She wrote on her blog, "I guess I was lulled into a false sense of security regarding my anonymity because I knew that Belle du Jour, who is another famous anonymous sex blogger, was hounded by the press and still managed to keep her identity private. Whilst I may have a high-traffic blog and a book detailing my sexual adventures in the shops, I'm not a prostitute like her, so why, I figured, would anyone really be interested in whom I am? But of course people are. The subject matter that I write about creates intrigue. People want to know who the women behind the explicit tales really are, and now they've managed to find out." This year, on the 2007 anniversary of her outing, she blogged, "I could talk about how I was the laughing stock at work, everyone in the UK film industry knowing and discussing the most intimate details of my sex life. I could talk about how I had to go into hiding and how for weeks the tabloids poked their long lens cameras through my parents' letterbox and rang their doorbell and telephone constantly, making both me and my parents live in a state of anxiety. I could talk about how profoundly I was affected by the articles on me, both in the media and online, how I wanted to challenge the lies, misrepresentations, and personal attacks, but could not. I could talk about how I rejected money from the gutter press for an exclusive because I didn't ask to be in the limelight and then resorted to do an interview with The Guardian in the hopes that it would make the tabloids disappear from my and my parents' doorsteps. It did. I could talk about how I wasn't made rich by the book and that by losing my film career as a result of it made me worry that I wouldn't be able to pay my rent." She worked on the Harry Potter movies, by the way. "I could talk about how my friends were offered money to spill the dirt on me and people from my past suddenly reappeared in my life, making me paranoid that I couldn't trust anyone. I could talk about how all of my ex-lovers contacted me, concerned that I had disguised them fully, all of them now aware of my previous hidden feelings about them." I'll show you. That's a picture of her. "I could talk about how I lost all my confidence with men, that face-to-face I was terrified and totally self-conscious. I could talk about how I then decided to give online dating another go, only to discover that somehow every man I got into conversation with, ended up on a date with, knew I was Abby Lee and was a fan of the blog, making me immediately scamper in the other direction because I felt so vulnerable. I could talk about how most all the men I've met and or been intimate with have asked me not to write about them, even when we've had no more than a pint together. I could talk in explicit detail about all the hot or not sex I've had, but feel too exposed now that everyone knows who I am and my friends, colleagues, and acquaintances all read the blog. I could talk about all these things on the blog if I were still anonymous, but I'm not. My outing last year was a huge strain on me, and yes, I've managed to find a silver lining out of it, but the ability to freely do the one thing that gave me such pleasure, blogging, has been destroyed. Take the anonymity away from a blogger who depends on it, and you get a blog with no heart. True sincerity and authenticity about events, people, thoughts, and feelings rely on anonymity. I'll challenge anyone who says that anonymity shouldn't matter when someone's writing about their own life. It does." I think it's something that all bloggers struggle with. So, active threats to sexual privacy besides us humans being threats to ourselves, evidently. Oh no, Bukkake again. 2257 laws. Is anyone in the audience familiar with the so-called 2257 laws? Okay, again, about half the audience. So I'll do the quick nutshell. 2257 refers to regulations under the Child Protection and Obscenity Enforcement Act of 1988, Mies Commission, which specifies record-keeping requirements for those wishing to produce sexually explicit media and imposes criminal penalties for failure to comply. This is intended to ensure that no person under the legal age is involved in such undertakings, although is, of course, only pursued within the realm of the perfectly legal adult porn industry. This is being delivered with snark, by the way. The regulations are directed toward the terms primary producer and secondary producer. A primary producer is defined in the set of rules as any person who actually films, videotapes, or photographs a visual depiction of actual sexually explicit conduct. A secondary producer is defined as any person who produces, assembles, manufactures, publishes, duplicates, reproduces, or reissues a book, magazine, periodical, film, videotape, or other matter intended for commercial distribution that contains a visual depiction of actual sexually explicit conduct. Different record-keeping requirements exist for primary versus secondary producer. One may be both a primary and secondary producer. This is funny, actually. The regulations also spell out requirements for the maintenance, categorization, location, inspection of records, unless, of course, you're in another country, as well as legal grounds for the exemption of these requirements. They require that the records be maintained for 5 years after the dissolution of a business that had been required to maintain them. Not surprisingly, this has come under many legal challenges, as the definitions of actual sexually explicit conduct and secondary producer are vague. So at one point, a friend of mine who, when some of the 2257 stuff came down a couple years ago, was having to go through some older files on a website for a company that he was working for, was literally having to look at images and go, okay, so if I look at this, do I think that her ass is red from a spanking or a sunburn? So this is sort of the position that people were put into trying to figure out if they had images that were actually sexually explicit conduct. I think that these definitions are vague intentionally so. Just as the definition of obscenity is left to so-called community standards, for instance, a fisting DVD would not be obscene by community standards in San Francisco, but would be in Laramie, Wyoming, I believe these laws are intentionally vague, mafia-style, to keep anyone who comes near a porn image ever unsure if they are in violation of the law. She looks really young, doesn't she? It's really creepy. Just Google 2257 ID, and you get images like this. So it's a good thing she has her ID, actually. She does look really young. Sexual privacy-wise, this poses a serious threat to sex workers, notably porn performers, and extras in video and imagery the government might consider sexually explicit conduct. For example, more than once, for Fleshbot and for my personal blog, porn creators have offered me the requisite 2257 materials when I make a blog post about their newest film or photo shoot, because of course everyone wants me to help promote their stuff, right? And I'm like, yeah, so give me something with boobies in it. It's good. To my alarm, I'm FedEx DVDs with scans of each performer's driver's licenses, social security cards, and images of them holding them next to their faces, and copies of their contracts and signatures complete with their current address and all personal information like their true names. The performers have no idea this information has been sent to me, nor even who I am. And this business practice is commonplace. Now, again, Google 2257 ID. Ta-da! Fourth page. Some low-grade sites I've found allow surfers to click through and see the photo IDs of the models, not blurred out as you can see in this photo. I believe we have yet to see the dark ramifications of the privacy protections these sex workers no longer have. And a quick aside I wanted to mention, too, about 2257 and about government policing of 2257 records of porn companies. In August of this year, the New York Post reported on the new federal porn ultimatum. The Department of Justice wants to come up with an official list of every porn star in America and slap stiff penalties on producers who don't cooperate. The new rules proposed under the Adam Walsh Child Safety and Protection Act would require blue movie makers to keep photos, stage names, blah, 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 all the 2257 information on file for the inspection. The identity of every performer is critical to determining and ensuring that no performer is a minor. Is actually in the proposal, but what they're talking about is making lists of people, and I just have to say, when governments start making lists of people, it's worrisome. So, what else do we need to worry about? 2.0 sites with dodgy terms of use policies and privacy policies. Social networking sites have no idea where they fall under things like 2257 regulations as to their role or to their users, and they have been fumbling blindly with the notions of community standards with disastrous and embarrassing results, as we've all seen with things like Flickr and with TribeNet. Who else do we need to worry about? Oh, and I want to add, too, some of you might, if some of you are familiar with the kerfluffle that I recently had with Flickr, where they put me in the bucket where a whole bunch of my stuff was censored, including like photos of my cat and photos of my vacation with my boyfriend and stuff like that. It was really kind of creepy because I had been actually following their rules, and I don't know why I got put in the wrong bucket, whether it was someone complained about me or what. But photos that I put up that I held as private and friends and family only, then I realized were being gone through by Flickr staff and being looked at. So I actually felt pretty violated by having to come under reexamination by Flickr. So I was like, I kind of don't know if I want them looking at those photos either, right? Anyway, I have a different site for those photos. Who else do we need to worry about? Anti-porn pundits. Ex-porn star transformed. If sexual interest in all its diversity were considered normal, we wouldn't have people like former porn performer and born-again Christian, hide your face, Shelley Lubin, giving her talk at Google at last September 21st, appealing to Google that, quote, porn is a pandemic that is spreading across America, fatally weakening the population. It is evil. It is contagious. It is addicting. The largest group for accessing and viewing porn online is ages 12 through 17. If we don't do something soon, we will have an entire generation of porn addicts who will one day become our leaders and politicians. Google is by far the most powerful search engine and has the power to make a difference in the lives of millions of children, women, and men. Google, will you help me change the course of history and protect Americans? Google records all its talks, by the way, so you can take a look at her talk. And I'm also going to be giving a talk at Google next Friday. So, indeed, look out for that. Precisely. What's important to know is that Shelley Lubin is a proponent. She was a porn star. She performed as Roxy. She was famous for like Roxy's Big Gangbang or whatever. And she was in porn about 10 years ago. So she's really, and you can tell, like, I looked at the breakdown for her talk, and she's citing all these crazy erroneous statistics based on studies that pretty much don't exist about how everyone in porn was abused as a child and everyone in porn has herpes and AIDS and, like, all this, like, really cuckoo crazy shit. And what's important to know, though, is that she's going and she's speaking at places like Google, and she is an active CP80 proponent. And CP80 is something that some of you might want to get familiar with. It's Utah legislation that's been an ever-evolving pet project that almost passed in a different form very recently, but looks like it may pass in its current version because the wording is deliciously vague. And the legislators, of course, have they don't know a router from their ass from a hole in the ground. CP80, at essence, says that anyone providing open wireless access that a minor uses to access pornography will be subject to a fine. Repeated violations are subject to criminal and or civil prosecution. So basically, as you can see, yay. So I want to conclude the talk with talking about who needs sexual privacy the most, just sort of underscoring why it's so fucking important. Not just bloggers, porn performers, and people answering Craigslist ads. Lesbians, gays, bisexual, and transgender people. Those identified by their sexual orientation or gender identity, regardless of their interest in the sex act. In most places, LGBT and questioning people face hostility from within as well as the outside world. Community healing, hookups, and hot porn can be found online. Matthew Shepard found out in 1998 that being gay in Wyoming was a death sentence. Brutal transgender murders like Brandon Tina from the movie Boys Don't Cry, as you all know, is based on a true story, still happen, as evidenced in the 2002 murder of 17-year-old Gwen Arujo from Newark, California. But with a quick Google search now, trans identity becomes more of a community and less of a mystery or a, quote, gay panic murder defense when justice should have been served in her case. Anyone with an outsider sexual interest, such as a fetishist, and by fetishist, I don't mean people hanging from stuff around here. I mean people who are into balloons or fornophilia, which is like human furniture fetishes, sort of outsider fetishes. Anonymity and privacy allows someone who feels alone, possibly self-hating and misunderstood, and often a fetishist hides their favorite way to masturbate from their chosen sex partners for life. It allows them to find community. Who else is it important to? Of course, obviously, BDSM and kink-interested people. It seems pretty garden variety for those of us who are here in this room and those of us who live in San Francisco that BDSM and kink is a fairly normal, safe, sane, consensual sex practice. But it's not in other places. Those interested in power exchange sex, bondage, sensory play, pain, complicated scenarios and predicaments that involve fear and power over scenes are common targets for media discrimination. Until Hollywood gets over it and the dinosaur-era mainstream media outlets stop showing BDSM as abuse, using it as a trope for female degradation, and telling us that kink and BDSM are dark and dangerous habits that can kill you, SF Weekly 2 weeks ago, and psychiatrists stop categorizing it as an illness, privacy and anonymity is essential. Who else needs privacy online? Anyone seeking non-biased, accurate sex information. That's any kid in the Bible Belt worried that they're pregnant because their boyfriend came on their leg, which is an actual question that has come over the SFISI hotlines. Trans people so desperate that they want to self-medicate with hormones. Someone wondering if they're gay. Someone trying to asphyxiate themselves during masturbation without killing themselves. The guy who just wrote me 3 nights ago about a broken condom with his girlfriend. Or the girl that emailed me last month after having sex and couldn't stop the bleeding. That guy with a flashlight stuck in his ass who should have just visited sfsi.org first. All of these people need anonymity, and they need to be safe finding it. Who else needs anonymity and protection? Women. In a January Nielsen Net Ratings poll, they found that 1 in 3 women looked at porn online, and that's just those who felt brave enough to self-disclose that they were looking at it. Of course we're looking at porn, but we're doing it in privacy because we can now. We're more empowered as ever to ask for what we want sexually, at least of ourselves, in anonymity, and be and fuck whoever we want in whatever form we want in places like Second Life. Female bloggers don't need to be sex bloggers to have serious need for online privacy, but gender makes us sexual targets, as we all know. I don't need to communicate to you how women are sexual targets. Statistically, we all know a female rape victim. Cyberstalking gets horrifically ugly when it's focused on women. As I mentioned earlier, who else needs sexual privacy? Sex workers. Of all genders, this means porn stars and lots of other kinds of sex workers, cam girls, etc. Their online privacy also equals their physical safety, and different jurisdictions may or may not agree. Who also needs privacy? This is often overlooked. Sex shoppers. Porn and sex toy consumers, customers, people who plunk down their credit cards and personal info online all too often without assessing the risk of doing so. There's often so much sexual shame involved in whatever they're buying, they tend to just go for it. And many adult companies' issues with credit card chargebacks will attest to this. Some companies bait and switch customers, saying they'll ship in a, quote, plain brown wrapper while selling customer info to third parties. And as we all know, swingers now need sexual anonymity more than ever. Who else needs sexual anonymity more than ever? For real? Everyone. Anyone who could lose a job, a lover, a friend, a court case, a child custody or visitation, a freedom under the Constitution, or could face physical or emotional harm from being outed for their interest in sex or sexual identity. The question is, what do we do about it? It's a good fucking question. They need protection too. I think that it's turning into a case of informed risk and harm reduction. And these are sex ed terms for safer sex, and I'll explain that. For everyone, sexual privacy online should be seen as a case of informed risk and an attempt at harm reduction, just like with safer sex. Simply put, harm reduction is a progressive approach to public health which takes into account that people are going to engage in risky behaviors, even if they know better or not. Unprotected sex, drug use, and I'd like to add, sex in the internet. Harm reduction attempts to mitigate risks and dangers by creating alternatives rather than just say no, don't drive drunk, or abstinence education. Harm reduction creates designated driver campaigns and controversial initiatives, like the provision of condoms in public schools and needle exchange programs. Opponents counter that harm reduction condones unsafe activities. I think that with sex online, and particularly with porn, it's more extreme because pervasive cultural attitudes are so deeply anti-sex and sex negative. Sexual interest is considered immoral in both media and government. And may I add, people like Shelley Levin and people like proponents of CP80 are running around doing this for the children, which, by the way, should be a red flag for anyone's other intentions. Anytime they say they're doing it for the children, it's time to take a look at what they're really doing it for. I think it's now almost become a civic duty to tell people how to protect their sexual privacy. Because it's the most vulnerable kind. I have a huge safer porn surfing page on my website for that exact reason. Users need to know basics about protecting their identity, and I think online porn businesses and non-businesses like Craigslist and even Google, oh yeah, I'm going to tell them, should educate their users in a non-biased way, and it's urgent for them to do so. At the very least, there are basic general privacy guidelines that anyone should consider basic safety precautions, right up there with always use lube for anal sex. Like, don't surf from work, or even a work computer laptop on loan, don't use your real name in forums, and never give out personal information to anyone. You'd be surprised how few people really know this. So, thanks for the free porn. People are going to do uninformed and sometimes dumb things with their sexual privacy on the internet. As I said earlier, knowing the risks, the horny surfer will still click a risky link to get off, or because they're curious. Why? Because I do too. And that's it. I'm sorry if that came out more as a sermon, but it's really just been such a burning issue, and it's been something that I feel has needed to be communicated for such a long time, and I don't feel like people are talking about it enough. So, thank you. Does anyone have any questions?
Is anyone in Congress defending sexual privacy and anonymity?
That's a good question, and I don't think so. There might be someone in the audience that has an answer for that. Is Jason here? Do you know of anyone?
I read the Free Speech Coalition's Free Speech Express every week, and I see a lot of localities trying to put porn out of business and put shops out of business, and not a lot of movement in Congress in favor of privacy, and not a lot of Congress people or senators speaking out. So,
and that's I recently went out to dinner with some people who have been working with the Free Speech Coalition, who have been lobbying in California for 2257 issues and free speech issues. And I was quite frankly surprised at how unweb savvy and untech savvy they were. So I was feeling a little strange about that. Did you have a response, Jason?
Just real quick, one of the best strategies for defending privacy like this, I think, is to coalition. And so I think the only successful strategies I've seen are, I work at the EFF, we work with the ACLU, we try and say there are a lot of people who are trying to speak anonymously online. This is one aspect of it, but whistleblowers who are trying to out, you know, corporate corruption, people who maybe, you know, children who are being abused by people who want to talk about it or seek out things. I mean, so there are some representatives who are open to a general message, but this is a hot button issue when, honestly, if you start talking about sexual privacy, they close their door. So, unfortunately, there isn't much hope, I think, talking about this specific issue, but if you can sort of coalition as a general issue with these other issues that are more palatable, you have a little more hope. But in the courts, it actually has some chance, although as you talked about with the Ninth Circuit case recently, not as much as we had hoped.
I think you've been waiting a long time, though.
Not that long.
Okay.
It's a little bit peripheral, but you were talking about the negative media image, and you mentioned in an SF Weekly article. I'm just not familiar with that. I don't know if you could touch on that real quick, what that was.
Okay, sure. 2 weeks ago, the SF Weekly ran a cover story called Sex and Murder. And on the cover, it was big. The words were big and bold. And S and the and M were bright red. So there was a direct association between the practice of SM and murder. Obviously, everything kinky leads down the evil dark road to death if you play with it. And what really sucked about the article was that it was, basically it was about Joe, I think Konopka is how you pronounce his last name. He was an anti-drug activist in the Upper Haight for a very long time. He was a very respected community individual, and he was into SM. He was into really heavy SM play, from what I understand. And he was found dead in his BDSM gear. And they know that he was seeing gay male prostitutes. There are a lot of conjecture. Still, we don't know what really happened to him. And the SF Weekly article ran what in the beginning was a fairly unbiased bio on Joe, and then concluded with the dark evil dangers of SM. And it was 2 weeks before Folsom, So I thought it was extremely distasteful and very disrespectful to a variety of communities. And I thought it was really interesting that when I tried to go get an actual physical copy of it, I live in the Castro, it had been ripped out of all the SF Weekly bins in the Castro. So I had really pissed somebody off, I think.
I know a lot of our sexual privacy law is based on things that don't really have anything to do with sex whatsoever. I was wondering if you could speak to the combination of various industries that don't seem to have anything to do with sex whatsoever that precedent law turns into issues with sex.
What would be interesting, I think, would be to reverse engineer, actually, sexual privacy in a way so that, well, what, where my mind just went with this is to sort of reverse engineer in a way of like, okay, so like looking for sex and searching for sex online, you know, and looking at all the sort of dirty tricks that a lot of different sites try to employ to get you to do click-throughs and employ to get you to do, you know, all these different things and surrender personal information and stuff like that are almost exactly the same tactics that are used by pharmaceutical companies and real estate companies and travel sites. And so to sort of reverse engineer the application of different types of laws, you know, depending on what level of sex or porn or sex toys that you're talking about, is, you know, it would be interesting to see privacy laws enforced on regular sites that then would have to overflow onto other sites. Although I don't know that I would trust government enforcement of anything like that. I mean, I'm really... As Jason mentioned, it's such a hot button topic and it's such a forbidden taboo zone, and every time people try to push legislation through, they're like, it's for the children, and everybody just clamps shut and is like, oh my God, children are being abused. And it's so ridiculous that I feel like we need to do it on a grassroots level and be educating people as much as we can, because it's just, you know, they're gonna get us for tax evasion, right?
I liked what you had to say about the getting those 2257 records. I didn't realize that companies were actually sending those out with their DVDs and that sort of thing. And the posting pictures online was really interesting. And so I had a question for you, because you're kind of the model of a secondary producer under the 2257 regulations, which is to say you are republishing images from other people's pornography. So you're not making it yourself, but you're republishing those images. So I wonder if you could just talk about what you would recommend to other secondary producers that they do when they get those records in the mail, and what maybe what you're doing and how you're handling it as an activist.
That's a great question. And it's not just, it's interesting too, because it's not just me as being considered a secondary producer, but it's also me myself posting pictures of myself naked. Because the really creepy picture of the really super young girl, that's on her website. That's her own pay site. So she has to have her 2257 information for her site. So the question is, what do secondary producers do, or what do people who may or may not be considered secondary producers do? Well, it's a question of risk assessment and harm reduction, as far as I'm concerned. I can't prescribe what I think anyone should do who does the type of blogging that I do, because really we have no map and we have no model for it. There have been no example cases. At this point, no one's gone after any secondary producers. The only primary producer, they've been doing raids on primary producers in Southern California, which are just the major mainstream adult companies, which is, you know, of course, totally for the children. And the only person who's actually been prosecuted has been Joe Francis from Girls Gone Wild. But, for instance, on Flushbot, we have a 2257 disclaimer that says, this is an adult site, you're looking at adult materials. We do not have an age check page. I have an age check page just because I think it's sort of the polite thing to do, because I feel that if someone is going to visit my website, they need to be warned that they're going to see something that they may or may not want to see. But as far as what I do, I just sort of take it on a case-by-case basis, and I make a risk assessment every time I decide to put a photo on my site. In terms of receiving the 2257 information, I don't want it. I don't want it. The first time I got a set of DVDs, I was just like, 227, what's this? And like stuck it in my computer. It wasn't that bad, but it felt like that. Because when I saw these people who I'd been seen as porn performers for ages, I was like, oh my God, that's Evan Stone's real name? Oh shit, that's his home address and his driver's license number, and that's a social security number, and these are all the names he's ever performed under, and this is, you know, this is all of his phone numbers and his contact information, and this is his email address. And I was like, I've never met the guy in my life, and I kind of hope I never do. But it was just, and it was for everyone that was in the entire film that I just had a few stills from, because it was requirements that they send this to me, and it was just like, you know, all these young women and these men, and they didn't know that I had this information, and I don't want the responsibility of having that information. It's awful. I don't like having it in my house. I don't want to be responsible for it. If someone broke into my house and stole it, I mean, that would just be really fucked up, right? So it puts us all in a really difficult and uncomfortable position, and I think that that's part of my conspiracy theory. I think that's part of the engineering behind the way that the 2257 laws are put together, because I think they're put out there to basically intimidate everyone who has something to do with porn in one way or another into just not having anything to do with it. So I don't have... My answer is I don't have an answer at this point. So, except I don't want that stuff at my house. I don't want their information. I don't know that I see any direct policy changes, but are you familiar with, what is his name? It is the mayor of San Diego. Oh, I just watched the video again last night. The mayor of San Diego, about 3 weeks ago, in a very, very emotional speech. Sorry? That's it, yes. At least we can see this on the LGBT front, because the very, very Republican and very conservative mayor of San Diego, who has been for 30 years a hardcore conservative Christian, card-carrying Republican, has always been anti-gay, anti-gay marriage, in a very emotional speech, completely flipped his stance on gay marriage. And by the end of his speech was actually crying, saying that he received the signed, you know, bill on his desk and had promised his constituents and promised everyone that he was going to toe the party line and not sign it and refuse because, you know, it's separate but equal, you know, but that he couldn't live with himself because his daughter is gay, the people that he work with are gay, and that their orientation shouldn't have anything to do with their equal human rights under the law. So I think that if we're going to see any type of, I think that's the beginning of a sea change, and I think what Gavin Newsom did was fucking awesome, but I think that what just happened in San Diego is an even more powerful sign of the sea change, and I think that if we're going to start to get any sort of headway into sexual privacy rights and sexual anonymity rights and just sexual rights as a culture, it's going to be through the wedge and the great activism of the LGBT community. So it's a start. That's it? Okay.